One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Wait, wait, wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. Today, we're honored to welcome Andrea Seidel to our podcast. Andrea is a multifaceted professional. She's a certified coach, an accomplished author, and she has a master's degree in happiness studies and positive psychology. And that equips her with some pretty cutting edge tools to support people on their recovery journeys. And she is the founder of Ready for Recovery, where she challenges the traditional notion that you have to hit rock bottom to initiate change. Personal experiences have included loving and losing someone to addiction. And through her books like Saving You is Killing Me, she supports our community, and she is an invaluable resource for people navigating the complexities of loving someone with addiction. Welcome, Andrea.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me, Sonia, and thanks for everything that you, both you and Kathleen, do.
Oh, no, we're so excited to have you here. So can you tell us a little bit about your personal journey and what led you to the recovery space?
Yeah, well, as we all know, addiction comes with a dark cloud, and it's cast on a lot of people. Even if you're not the one struggling with addictive behaviors per se, there are so many people around that are impacted. My journey started with loving someone who was struggling with addictive behaviors and in denial and hiding the addiction. And then eventually, obviously, you can't hide it forever, and it's an active addiction. And our relationship just started breaking down, and I was doing everything to save, fix, help, what anyone would do when they love someone so wholeheartedly and watching them struggle. And I was noticing that I was just getting broken and just depleted in trying to help, so and fix and save and rescue. And then finally, I realized what I was dealing with. So a lot of answers came up once we knew we were dealing with addiction. So I always say I lost my sparkle and I was really struggling. And my formal education is in positive psychology and resilience and well-being. This was one of the hardest things I've ever gone through. And I realized that, I need to turn this pain into purpose. I need to help those who love someone with an addiction, because I literally felt like saving him was killing me. And that's the birthplace of my book, Saving You is Killing Me, Loving Someone with an Addiction, because I knew that I wanted to draw on all the psychological tools, the interventions to help bring yourself back, how to recover yourself. And I was destined, and just like knowing that I'm going to help that, I'm going to serve that community of those who love someone with an addiction. And then I realized really fast that all these tools of recovery that I was working with, and all these, like my formal education, everything could help all these people that are also struggling with addictive behaviors. And we, let's face it, we all have some degree of addictive behaviors, and we all have opportunities to recover, to reclaim, to get ourselves back. We all kind of pivot a little bit in the person that we desire to be. And so I realized that, you know what, I also can, and this took 4 years later, 4 years of processing a lot of anger, a lot of hurt, a lot of frustration, that okay, I'm ready now to also support those who are struggling with addictive behaviors, because my addicted loved one would never have admitted that he has a problem. I would, like, you know, have the back and forth, the roller coaster and the promises and things like that. But I realized that he didn't identify with needing recovery. He didn't have that identity. He did not identify with needing to go to a 30-day rehab, because there's such a stigma around the word recovery. And there's such a stigma around, like, we think that we need to hit rock bottom in order to seek help. And so I felt like, oh my gosh, like, here's an opportunity to help all those people that I call them the in-betweeners, where they're not quite identifying with, I have a problem, I need to go to a 30-day rehab, that kind of approach. Is like, they may not identify with that. So I'm not bad enough, so to speak. I haven't hit rock bottom. And so that's why I wrote this book, Recovery Without Rock Bottom, because why do we have to wait for such a low point? And I was hoping that maybe I could have saved my loved one. So that's how, there's the birth of it. There's my story, basically, a long, long answer to your question.
Yeah. Was there any idea of a 12-step when you were going through this, like Alan, or do you feel like those groups sort of equated with that rock bottom?
Yeah, I do believe that any resource and all resources are essential. And I did seek out and went to a lot of meetings myself when I was in the muck of loving someone with an addiction. And I felt like there could be an on top of that sort of approach. And because it doesn't always resonate with everyone. And so finding what works for you. And then I also felt it's scary going to some of those meetings, and it's also intimidating potentially. And so that's why I supported that I call it my community, because it's like loving someone with an addiction. I knew that there were resources to help build yourself back up. And then I realized, okay, we can tap in, because my formal education is in psychology and happiness studies, and it's not a happyology, like pretending bad things don't happen. This is actually grounded in research of how we can help build ourselves back up, how we can look after and safeguard our mental health and our mental well-being. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that there was a missing piece to the puzzle. And I knew that, and I know from all the amazing resources in the world of psychology and, you know, that there are so many things and resources that we can add to. So even if someone's going to AA or working the 12 steps, you could still benefit from the resources of building yourself back up, of recovering yourself, of tapping into the psychological tools such as cognitive behavior therapy and reframing or active acceptance and commitment therapy and positive psychology in general. Like, there's so many amazing things. Instead of focusing on what we have to, you know, hit rock bottom, or we have to, what we have to take away, we can focus on embracing what's working. What are our strengths? How can we cultivate more goodness in our life and more joy-filled moments? How do we do that? How do we get ourselves back in that regard? So again, a long answer to your question. It's like, yeah, I feel like there's never enough resources. And I think finding what works for you, but then that in-betweener too, where someone may not identify with or even know about the resources of Al-Anon and looking for ways to reclaim their life and focus on themselves.
So how does Ready for Recovery differ from traditional programs?
Yeah, so traditionally, we are waiting for crisis. We're waiting for rock bottom. We're waiting for the moment where we feel like our lives are just like, oh my gosh, collapsing all around us. And so how this approach differs is that we don't need to wait for that. So we don't need to wait for our lives to crumble around us. And so the premise of this is that recovery is for everyone. It's not for someone waiting for a rock bottom moment. And I'm not saying there is a place for that where we, if you are in crisis, there is a need for, you know, a lot of the support that's out there in traditional recovery. This is just recognizing that we can foster more resilience. We can build ourselves up, that recovery is not about loss necessary. It's about reclaiming and bringing yourself back and recognizing and regaining well-being. And so it's different in that it's really focusing on not what we need to get rid of or the behaviors we need to stop. It's more focusing on what can we reclaim? What can we build? What can we restore in our life? It's like when you lose a wallet, right? You look around for it and you want to recover it. And that's literally what that word recovery means. The only thing now, it's kind of gotten this stigma around it. And so building on this, recovery is more about possibility. And that is the approach that's different a little. It's taking back the true meaning of recovery and redefining it. And so my book is really all about reclaiming, restoring, reconnecting to you. It's also recovery. It's like when you injure yourself, it's like you recover from that injury.
Yeah,
it's not just about stopping destructive behaviors. It's about creating a life that you don't want to escape from.
Yeah, what's interesting is on the spectrum of alcohol use disorder, I was much further along than my ex-husband. But when I quit drinking, I was the one like doing all the work. And he really was like, well, I'm just being supportive by not smoking weed and not drinking. And I think that that was part of the issue, right? Is that he didn't recover because he didn't see it as that bad, but he just took away this huge coping mechanism. He smoked weed every day and just took it out, but didn't replace it with anything. And then I found him just like trying to get dopamine hits all over the place. So
yeah,
that's so interesting to me. So I always ask people this is, what are some red flags that happen before you reach rock bottom? And from both sides, like from the person who's suffering from the addiction and from that, what were the red flags that you saw that were like well before that crisis point?
That's such a good question. And also circling back to what you shared, and thank you for sharing that, is you nailed it on the head there. It's like this is so damaging. You can see how the whole idea of we need recovery and having that mindset of, you know, recovery is for those people that are like, right? And so see how that is so damaging because it prevents someone from seeking help or from making some positive changes or from tweaking, recalibrating their lives. And so sometimes we think that it needs to be really, really bad. And so to your point, the red flags are like, well, what are the red flags, right? They could simply just be a recognition that, you know, I'm not showing up exactly how I want to be. Like, and it could just be like, you know, my three glasses of wine now have turned into a whole bottle. And then I kind of wake up groggy. And then the next day I'm like, you know, I'm not working as well as I usually, don't have the same energy. My workouts aren't as good. Or, you know, and then I come home, it's like, oh, you know, I commit, like I'm saying, okay, I'm not going to drink during the week. And then sure enough, here I am drinking during the week.
Yeah.
It's just recognizing and getting honest with yourself too, is just noticing the behaviors, because it's a slippery slope. And so what happens is just by catching it and noticing what for you are red flags. We don't have to say, okay, like wait till we're not making it to work. A lot of us are functional. Struggle with functional addictive behaviors. Like we're very functional in our life. But what might be happening is it might be impacting your relationships. It might be impacting your work. It might be just impacting your energy levels and your well-being. Like I know when I drink lots of wine, I'm dehydrated. My skin looks wrinkly and my eyes are like not as white as usual. And that's one of my personal struggles. And so it doesn't have to be so-called red flags. And we don't have to necessarily go, okay, sobriety. Like, I'm going to be like all or nothing thinking. Mm-hmm. It could just be, I always say less is still less, right? Yes. And so, and sometimes, and that's the difference as well. You're asking about how my book and approach is different, is that it doesn't have to be extremes. It can just be recognition that, okay, you know what? maybe drinking that much during the week isn't great for me and I'm not showing up the best version of who I could be and who I want to be. You know, if I value, it's going back into what you value. I value having lots of energy. I value having radiant skin and I value being an example and a role model to my children. And, you know, because my children are turning into teens and my son's actually turning 23. And so I don't want them to see that version of me. And so I value that. So moving my focus into like recognizing that, first of all, that sometimes our addictive behaviors are slippery slopes and just recognizing that, okay, I might be on this and I feel like I have control over it, but I'm also recognizing that I think I want to pivot. I think I want to recover a little bit more of that best version of me that I can. And I know that's that saying best version of me sort of cliche, like everyone says it, but it's really true. It's like, how do I want to be in my life? What brings me meaning? What brings me joy? How am I at my most vital? Because even when I overdrink or when I drink, and my definition of overdrinking for myself, I don't sleep well. It impacts me on so many levels. So to me, that's a red flag. Like, okay, Andrea, come on. I have these little pep talks with myself. And I also numb out. I'm bored. So what is it? So it's taking a step back and recognizing, what am I numbing out? What am I like? What emotions am I trying not to feel here? How can I experience these emotions and what would make me feel less alone, right? If I felt lonely or if I'm bored, what are other approaches that I can do to help me? It's looking at what we can do instead of what we want to remove.
Yeah, I always think like generally a red flag is if you're using alcohol for something other than, I really like the way this glass of wine tastes with dinner. Yeah. If you're using it for anything else, then it usually tips you off. But when you start talking to people, because I find I do this, and you probably don't because you're much more evolved, but I'm assessing, can this person really moderate, or are we going to try to moderate for 3 months? And then are we just going through this process to get to abstinence eventually? Or do you really believe that almost anyone can moderate?
That is such a powerful question, and it's so individual. And maybe they are at a point where they might need more support, and maybe, you know, and if you're at that stage where you need additional support with like medication or things like that to help, of course. So let's talk about the disease model and the learning model.
Yeah.
And I believe that it's kind of a bit of both. And so what happens is the reason they call it a disease model is because we change the reward circuitry in our brain. And so what happens is, We are rewiring our brain. So there's a physiological change, we create neurological pathways. We get the reward, the dopamine surge. And then what happens is when our addictive behaviors become more and more worse and worse, and we're doing more to get the effects that we have dependent, then what happens is we are actually changing our brain. And then that is why they call it a disease model, because by definition, there's actual change. So what the disease model does is it actually causes us to feel a little bit like a victim potentially, where while my brain is rewired, is changed, like I can't do anything about it, which is where I actually appreciate the learned model, where the learning model is where we create neurological pathways. We create the reward system where whenever it is that we're engaging in our addictive behaviors, we get a big dopamine release. We get a flood of feeling good. And then it feels good. Then our body says, yes, do more of that. And then what happens is that the more we do that, we create these deep trenches of neurological pathways. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, and I always say, it's almost like a trail. My grandpa's so sweet, bless him, he's passed away since, but he used to always walk to his barn to feed the horses. And he would take the same path, and you could see the pathway getting deeper. And every time I went there, like, you could see this muddy path that he took to the barn. And it's like our neurological pathway. The more we go down there, we have this learned behavior, and it's ingrained. It becomes a deep trench. And so the great news about this is that we have neuroplasticity, we have neurogenesis, we have the ability to create new neurological pathways. My grandpa could start walking a different path, of course, it's going to get hard. And then we have to start letting that older path get overgrown. So what I love about the learning model is it's so empowering. And even though we might have some deep trenches created from our addictive behaviors, because we are getting the reward system of like, oh, that feels good when I come home and my reward is relaxing and having a glass of wine after a busy day. I have that trench. I have that neurological pathway, right? But the great news is through repetition, through choices, through daily habits, through rituals, we can create other neurological pathways. We can create, and that is really the beauty of creating new pathways, neurogenesis, new hobbies, new things to do, new options, but then also neuroplasticity, changing the what we already have. So our brains are not hardwired. We have the capacity to rewire. It does take a lot of repetition, and we know it from neuroscience that this is possible. So the best thing we can do is to recognize that those trenches that we're building, they can keep getting deeper if we don't take initiative in our own life to create other neurological pathways. And no shame, no stigma around. It's just like a choice, a decision. It's like, I have the capacity to do this. And it's so empowering.
And so is there a difference between the depth of the trenches? Like the deeper the trench, the less you'll be able to moderate, or the deeper the trench, anything? Or yeah, how do you look at it?
Yeah. And there's no way to really know how deep our trenches are. Mm-hmm. And you're right. And it is definitely the message that I just want to give is possible, right? Mm-hmm. You know, think about trails that have been neglected for a while in the forest. They start overgrowing, sticks land on them, right? It's harder to walk on them. So the more that we can feel that ability and that hope around building other pathways. And it's not about perfection. It's just about daily, one day at a time, focusing on what path do we want to walk on today? Mm-hmm. And recognizing that if we go down that old path, it's like, okay, you know, and then just recognizing that we have that ability. And the more tools, and I always say the more, that's why I created the recovery principle, because there's a whole bunch of principles. So it spells R-E-C-O-B-E-R-Y. And yeah. So they're all stand for a well-being. And this is scientifically proven. These are basically based on science. The recovery principles are based from things like connections, optimism, gratitude, health and vitality, you empowerment. So it's all about focusing like, what are your growth mindset? How to meaning-making, engagement in your life, hobbies, new hobbies. Like there's all these things that we can, it's like a buffet. And the more we have in the buffet of things that we can approach, it really does help us with the neuroplasticity and the rewiring of our brain. And so, yeah, so I think that just the hope that can provide us is like, oh my gosh. And it is up to us. And this is the agency. And that's part of the hope theory. Is Schneider talks about this idea of we can have willpower, but we also need way power. And that's what hope is. Hope is believing in your agency. You're the agent of your life and your ability to pivot, to reclaim, to recover without any stigma around the word recovery.
I love that you come to it from such a positive angle, because I think that for me, sometimes my recovery comes from a place of fear, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I walk by a restaurant and I think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have a glass of wine? I play the tape forward and I scare myself into not having that glass of wine. So how do you see that? How do you see fear as a motivation? Or should I be focusing more on, but I'm going to feel so great tomorrow, which sometimes I do. Like, remember when I told you about True Diagnostics' True Age Test? I am obsessed with the idea of biological age versus chronological age. Let's dig a little deeper into what you can actually learn with this test. So with this simple at-home kit, TruAge analyzes hundreds of thousands of markers on your DNA to reveal your true biological age and how fast you're aging compared to normal. And since 90% of aging is lifestyle and environment, knowing this information gives you the power to make changes that can actually improve your longevity. Should I be sleeping more? Am I doing enough weights? And TruAge tells you how fast 11 key organ systems are aging, including your heart, brain, lungs, liver, and more. And as a former smoker and heavy drinker, I am curious to see how old my liver and lungs are. Also get a breakdown of more than 75 key longevity biomarkers. So things like metabolic health, immune response, distilled into actionable scores. TruAge was developed by doctors and scientists at Harvard, Yale, and Duke, drawing on one of the world's largest DNA methylation databases. So these insights are backed by science. What I love is that TruDiagnostic doesn't just give you data, they give you guidance. Along with your results, you'll receive personalized recommendations, basically anti-aging biohacks tailored to you, to help you improve those numbers and potentially reverse your biological age over time. It's like getting a roadmap to age better. I'm excited to see if my vegetarian diet is the healthiest option for me, or do I need to add a certain supplement to my diet? And the best part, it is super easy and convenient. The TruAge test is done at home. No doctor's visits or big needles. It's just a quick, painless finger prick. No vials of blood or awkward urine or stool samples. It was so easy. You just put that tiny little sample in a prepaid envelope, and in 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. Fast and hassle-free. If you're serious about longevity or just curious about what your body's real age is, head over to TruDiagnostic.com and use my code CIS2025 to get 20% off your entire order. This is your chance to take control of your aging and make every year count more for your health. Visit TruDiagnostic.com and use CIS2025 at checkout to get 20% off.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
3 out of 10 times, I think, I'm going to feel so good tomorrow because I'm not drinking. And then 7 out of 10, I'm like, I have to play the tape forward.
I love this. You just isolated what in psychology is called an implementation intention. So if I feel like I want a glass of wine, then I will play it forward and I'll give myself it's like you're unfolding what could possibly happen if you were to go down that route. I love the time and the space that you created in that moment, and you were able to look at it, reframe it, and then make a decision. You created that buffer, and it's so powerful. And yes, fear. And the whole first part of my book is listing all the reasons why we don't want to engage in those addictive behaviors. Mm-hmm. And if it is fear, like 100%, it's like I talk about how dehydrated I am in the morning. I don't like throwing up. And if I throw up, then like that's the worst. And then I made a list of all the reasons that those behaviors don't fall in line with what I value. They don't. So then here's your other list is, what do you value? What do you want? Who do you want to show up? How do you want to be? And just by doing that exercise alone is so powerful, because then you're looking at all, it's like, yeah, this is what happens when I go down that path of my addictive behaviors. and really like, and we're talking exaggerated. And I love that you've done that. You've basically, it's like, oh my gosh, if I do this, then it's a whole downward spiral. Then this happens. And for me, it's like I pick fights when I have too much wine and this and that. And then I feel guilty the next day. And so go down that path, even though it feels really yucky, but it's so powerful because you're painting that picture for yourself. And then what that does is it gives you that really deep feeling and embodiment of what happens when we engage in those addictive behaviors. So then what we do is aversion. And then we think about, well, what do I value? How do I want, if I close my eyes and I'm showing up as my ideal, most well, joy-filled person and I am living my good life, what does that look like? Mm-hmm. What are my strengths? Who do I want to be? How am I showing up? And seeing just that, painting that picture of the contrast like you do, is so powerful in then our choice making, our agency on what it is that we want to do in that moment. I love that. So implementation intentions, like though, and then what you do is you'd say, if this happens, I will. So it already, you have almost like your mantra.
Yeah.
So powerful if you feel triggered.
Yeah. The time I did it the most visually is I was in Portugal by myself and I walked by like a bar and people were having tapas and wine. And I thought, like, no one's even here. Like, what would happen if I had a glass of wine? And I thought, well, then I'm definitely going to have a glass of wine the next night at dinner. And then I always want to have champagne with lunch or brunch. So I'm definitely going to start doing that. And then I could see it really clearly. But I love that you talked about values. Kathleen and I talk about values a lot. And I think for me, my values shifted so much in sobriety. It was shocking, I think, because I started drinking so young, I didn't have a chance to really develop a value system and sort of just like rode on other people's. But it didn't happen overnight. Like it took years for, if you want to call it, emotional sobriety shift. But how have you seen, like, even with your loved one, how have you seen their values change for the worse and then for the better? How do you see that, like, value change process?
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely lost mine to addiction, so I don't see anything now at this point. I don't even know what his life is like. So values are so important for anyone. Whether you're struggling with addictive behaviors, whether you're struggling with anything in your life, like you're exposed to challenge. Like, and so even when I was in the muck of loving him and he was in my life in active addiction, I had to get so clear on my values because I was sticking it out through so much torture. And so it helped me get so clear. I had to go through that crab, so to speak, to get so clear on what I value. I value peace. I value respect. I value a loving relationship. I value having a man that wants to come and lie in bed beside me instead of staying out in the garage and doing cocaine all night.
Yeah.
Like, it's so amazing how sometimes when we're at what we call maybe a lower point, it's such a great opportunity actually to think about what it is that's really important to us. What do we value? What's important? And even if you have to pull up a whole list of potential values, right?
Yeah, I have one.
Yeah, and you highlight it and you're like, it's like, I value this. So it makes sense. If I value respect, it makes sense that when he talks so mean to me, that I just crumble, right? And so what that does, and there's so much that's tied around knowing what you value, because then you can slowly move. This is what you value. Here's where you are. How can I get closer to my values? Yeah. And you raise such an amazing point, is that it doesn't happen overnight. We call them minimal viable interventions. Mm-hmm. You know, shout out to Tal Ben-Shahar for that. They're minimum tiny little things that we can do on a daily basis that have huge impact. It's like the atomic habit. It's like a compound effect. And so moving slowly and acting in ways that align with your values is huge. It's so important for lasting change.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think that when we start talking about boundaries, how do you set boundaries when you love somebody with addiction? So you've established your values. Like, I don't want this guy who's out in the garage doing coke all night. And then how do you start setting the boundaries around?
Yeah. And that's like the million-dollar question, because boundaries seem so like obscure, I find. So what I always say, first of all, I always change the word boundaries to rules to live by, my rules to live by. And the reason I do that is that boundaries seem like you're trying to control someone else's behavior. So sometimes it would be like, if you come home at one, you're not coming in the house. Or if you do drugs again, mm-hmm. you're like, blah, blah, blah. Like a lot of people impose their boundaries onto others. And we simply don't have control over anyone else in our lives. So the only people we have control over is ourselves. So the circumstances obviously are going to happen around. We could say till we're blue in the face is like, I don't want you to be in the garage all night. I want you to come lie beside me. But mm-hmm. bottom line is, I don't have control over him. So so boundaries, I always change the words to more like, which is more approachable psychologically, is creating boundaries are for you. So rules to live by. So for me, for example, my rule to live by, and so I create a boundary for myself, is I don't want to drink as much as I am. And so what I do is my rule to live by is I know that if I drink, and I make a rule that if I drink a bunch of water, my 3 to 4 liters of water, then I allow myself to have one glass of wine. Mm-hmm. And so I make a rule to live by. So my rule is I cannot have my glass of wine until I've had my 3 liters of water. Mm-hmm. And so what that does is it usually helps me drink all my water. And then I allow myself to have that one glass of wine as almost like there's my so-called reward.
Yeah.
And then also rules to live by. I do not drink during the week. And so that you can see how that creating that rule to live by, it enhances I value and I remind myself, what's my why? Why do I have these rules to live by? It's because I value radiant skin. I value great energy. I value my sleep. I value being a great role model. I value being slim. And there's so many calories in wine, like blah, 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 blah. You can really delve into it. So yeah, so that helps me a lot, is looking at boundaries more as rules to live by for my own self, for my well-being. So what do I value? And then it helps you create your rules to live by, which makes boundaries naturally for you.
Yeah, I love that. I love the rules to live by. I love the idea. I think a lot of people could benefit from it. What is the Recovery Sunshine assessment tool?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, thanks for asking. So I'm sure you've heard of the wheel of life. And so you look at all the elements of your life and it's like it's symbolic of like a wheel, and then the spokes represent certain areas of your life. And so then you ask yourself, how bumpy is your ride? So I created the acronym, so Recovery. So they're all elements based on science, based on research, based on the amazing researchers in psychology, on the elements of well-being and how we can use these elements to bring about and allow us to shine bright and allow us to be the best balanced version of who we want to be. And so the sunshine, Recovery Sunshine is basically, it's like the rays of light represent each of the elements. So the R is resilience and growth. The E is empathy and compassion, and so on. And so you go through and you assess, hey, so it's like a snapshot. It's like, where in my life am I feeling a little out of balance? Like, okay, maybe it's vitality and health. It's like, okay, so what can I do? Or what some of the implementations that I can put? What are some active strategies or habits that I can start to integrate? So maybe I notice I haven't been sleeping. So let's create a ritual, a bedtime ritual. Or I notice that I've been choosing unhealthy foods. So as soon as you get a snapshot, it's almost self-awareness, then you can start to see where it is that you want to focus your energy on your life to create and bring about more balance. And so this is so important on our recovery journeys, on getting ourselves back, on reclaiming our life, is to take that snapshot, but then implement some new habits, some repetition and some reminders and things like that too, because change doesn't happen overnight. And then you can then take another snapshot. And so that's why I created it, because it's such a wonderful tool to help you with self-awareness, because we all have different things. Like maybe you haven't connected with someone. And as we know, isolation and loneliness, especially when it comes to struggling with addictive behaviors, is very common to feel alone, to feel isolated. And so one of the elements of well-being and shown to really help us to prevent depression and anxiety and help us process emotion is to connect with others, to have positive relationships in our life. So if your sunshine is low there, then you know, okay, who can I reach out to here? How can I call in a friend? What support group can I join?
What do you think the importance or the role of support groups is and having a recovery community? For me, I have really good friends and family that I can lean on that aren't necessarily in recovery. And then I do have people in recovery that sort of understand the specifics of, you know, the day-to-day. But how do you incorporate family into a recovery plan?
Oh, yes. Okay. So essential. Chris Peterson, he's like one of the fathers of positive psychology. And he basically narrowed down everything into other people matter. And we are social creatures and we are meant to be together and not in isolation. And so we do languish when we're on our own and when we feel like we're dealing with something ourselves or when we're isolating ourselves from the world. So reaching out is, and that's why it's one of the rays of the sunshine. Reaching out is so essential and feeling like you're not alone and giving yourself the permission to be human and recognizing when you are in a support community or you're in, even if it's, I have the Saving You Is Killing Me support group, Facebook group. And even if you're in there and you're just sharing or you're hearing other people's struggles, it makes you realize, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one struggling with this. Or it makes you realize that it also dissolves the stigma, so to speak, is that it's like, oh my gosh, you're struggling with drinking that much wine as well. It's like, here are some strategies or here's what works for me. Or being in community is one of the most important aspects of our recovery journey. It helps us almost be a mirror. It helps us with self-reflection, speaking and just talking things out as well with someone who understands, who's been there, who, you know, or even not, someone who is just a loving, supportive friend, a coach or a therapist, or even a close friend that you can confide in. And then sometimes it's like, we all have that friend that's like, Andrea, like, are you crazy? Like, this is the fourth time he's gone on a binge in this last month. Like, do you see how ridiculous this is? Like, what would you tell your daughter if she was dating someone like this, that's acting like this way? And sometimes I cannot emphasize more that the need for positive relationships and even if it is family, right? And I find even in the dynamic, it's very challenging of loving someone with an addiction and being in that dynamic because it's hard, right? And so making sure we're reaching out to people that can support us through. And when we are struggling, a lot of times when people struggle with addictive behaviors, there's shame around it. And removal from those social interactions is very common.
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things I've had to deal with is not my own, but like my brother's relapse. And so relapse is something that I think it's really hard for loved ones, right? Because you start to get comfortable and like, I got this new person. Like, so what are some things do you think we can look for in a loved one or even in ourselves that we're kind of maybe on the cusp of a relapse? How can we prevent a relapse before it happens?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we have no control over someone else. So that would be my first thing is that, you know, even if we try, we have those, we didn't cause it. We can't control it. We can't cure it. We know those. So that's what we can't do. So then the other flip side of it in the SYKM community, I talk about the four C's, which is self-care, self-compassion, courage, and community. So tapping back into your focusing back on you, the roller coaster of emotion when, and also the thing is that we get glimmers of hope. We see the person that we love and just, you know, giving you so much love around your brother and relapse. And that is so hard. And I know I was on that roller coaster too with my addicted loved one. And the problem is that we see glimmers of hope. We get love letters, we get promises, and then we're very hopeful because we love this person in our life and we care about them. So then what happens is we get that letdown, that disappointment. We get, you know, even sometimes we get trauma bonding, right? Where we're so relieved when things are going so well. And then suddenly it's like, oh, this again, we get so disappointed, hurt. Question, is it something we're doing, or am I not enough, or am I not fun enough? And this is why they do it. And it is so challenging. It's first of all, just giving yourself that permission to be human and to feel all those emotions of hurt, of disappointment, of despair. And it's because you care. And we don't necessarily want to slap you with like, okay, you're codependent, you're enabling, right? I always say you're showing up in a way that anyone would show up when you love and care someone so wholeheartedly. And so giving yourself that, just, you know what, you care so much. That's why this is so hard. And just offering yourself that understanding and self-care, like, what are you needing right now? And so oftentimes I'd be like, I'm exhausted. I would just need to rest, to remove myself from thinking about him. And just, I even needed distraction, but healthy distraction. So going to yoga and walking down my street, and so self-care, reaching out to community, but then also having the courage to focus on you and put your life back together. What do you have control over? Yeah.
So then where does like forgiveness sort of lie in that? Because I remember with my brother, he was in AA and he did the amends. And then when he started drinking again, I was like, are we going to do the amends again? Like restarting over? And I think one of the things that keeps him away is that kind of shame. And I think he really does want forgiveness for the things he does when he's using. And so how can we make that easier? Or do you even believe in that as part of the process?
So yes, it's 100%. And it's in my Saving You is Killing Me book. And it's all about forgive for good. And it's not about condoning. And it's really about, and there's a lot of research around forgiveness and what it is, it's who it's for. So forgiveness is really about, it's an approach to let go of any resentment, to let go of any of this emotional turmoil that comes from being in any relationship. And so forgiveness is actually a powerful tool to improve your mental and physical health. It reduces stress. It increases your happiness too. Mm-hmm. And so you raise such an amazing point, because it's like, oh my gosh, like I still have a red journal back there that I wrote in when I was dealing with a lot of ups and downs of being in that relationship. I had to, first of all, journal, right? I had to get all that anger out. Mm-hmm. I had to, we put that energy emotion, right? I had to, and I still have like pangs of anger towards him and disappointment. I'm just like, what a sad waste of a human, because he was amazing. And I was just hoping to get that version of him back all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I have to say that forgiveness is not about condoning and letting him off the hook. And so I had to learn that, because I kept thinking, no, I'm not never forgiving him for this. This is ridiculous. But then I realized that forgiveness is actually for you, the person doing the forgiveness, not them. So it's about releasing the grudges, the hurt, that heavy backpack with all those rocks in it. It's not about the offender. It's not about, so forgiveness is a choice just to release that anger and reclaim your inner peace. I'm no longer going to be mad at you. And I, not that I would say it to him. I even wrote, you know what? Here's all my anger. I get it all out. And I didn't send it to him. But then at the end, it's like, you know what? I'm no longer going to be mad at you, because it's just putting so much burden on my life. And it really shifted that perspective. It really helped. And it moved me from what we call in psychology from a grievance story. Like for me, I went through so much crap, to replaying and redoing my past wrongs. And you shift the narrative. And this is CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. You're shifting the narrative to breaking that cycle and allowing yourself to really heal and focus on what you can control, which is not them.
That's such a good lesson. I always think the writing of the letter and not sending it is such a great practice. And so we're going to link to your book, Saving You is Killing Me, at the in our show notes. But can you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah. So my most recent joy is Recovery Without Rock Bottom. I really wanted to move into that mission and also support I'm going to continue, obviously, supporting the SYKM community. But what's really exciting is that I realize that there are so many people and so many trailblazers when it comes to recovery, mm-hmm. and so much support needed, not for necessarily the rock bottom place, although traditional, you know, recovery programs, very, very important. But the in-betweener and the recovery community of when you just need that support to help, even if you're on the slippery slope of addicted behaviors, wherever you are on that spectrum, whether you want to seek sobriety or wherever you are, that is who I want to also help. And so Ready for Recovery magazine is just launched, and you and Kathleen are featured in it as yes. well. And we're so happy to have you in there. And that's an exciting resource that I'm just birthing. And I'm excited because, you know what? We want to have an approach to recovery that feels uplifting, that feels empowering, that yeah. feels like something that we that's approachable and not be stigmatized. Wow. And yeah, so that's exciting for me, too.
I love it. So we will link to that also in the show notes. And thank you so much for being here today, Andrea. I learned so much. I'm sure the listeners did too.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor. And just remembering that recovery isn't all about fixing what's broken. Yeah. It's about reclaiming your power, your happiness, and your life for sure.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to Sisters in Sobriety. And we will see you next week. This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.